It's Bigler's World. That's right. And I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour. I'm going to be reading all kinds of kids' magazines. What do we got? Some National Geographic Kids. Got a little Ranger Rick right here. Ranger Rick magazine. Let's start out with Time magazine for kids. Yes, it's Time for Kids. Hitting the Slopes is the name of this article by Lillian Stone. Lillian? See, it starts out, Aspen, Colorado. Eleanor Andrews, 17 years old, felt a thrill as she ripped down the street-style ski course at X Games, or is that 10 Games? X Games there in Aspen in 2025. As one of only three athletes under 18 competing in a ski event at the Games, Eleanor carved the mountain along with older athletes that she has idolized for years. And she says, it's just crazy to see all these women I've watched since I was really young, she told Time for Kids. Let's see. Courtesy X Games, from January 23rd to 25th, top snowboarders and skiers from around the world gathered in Aspen, Colorado. Some were teens, like Eleanor. In the X Games, kids don't have separate events. They compete against adults. Sometimes they take home medals anyway. Breaking records. South Korean snowboarder, see if I can pronounce this, Gaeon Choi, made history back in 2023. That year at 14, she became the youngest X Games competitor ever to win gold in a snowboard halfpipe event. The record previously belonged to Olympic gold medalist Chloe Kim. Kim has been a mentor to Gaeon. Let's see here. Now 16, Gaeon overcame a back injury to compete this year. During the snowboard super pipe event, she repeatedly soared into the air while zipping back and forth along a 22-foot tall half pipe. And she says, I don't think about the past, talking to Time for Kids through an interpreter after reflecting on her time off. Think of what you're going to be doing in the future. Rockstar rookies, snowboarders Lily, if I can pronounce this, Damwarveg, 15, and LJ Henriquez, 16, competed in their first X Games this year. Being rookies didn't hold them back. No, no. Lily scored a bronze medal in the snowboard knuckle huck. I don't like the sound of that. Is this her talking? She says, I'm definitely feeling excited, she told Time for Kids after her victory. A lot of adrenaline. And though he didn't medal, oh, it's a guy, he didn't medal, LJ gave his signature joyful performance. He boarded with a big smile on his face. Lily and LJ both competed in the new street style event, in which athletes create their own routine on a short course. They rode their boards over metal rails and up concrete barriers. Neither took home a medal for it, but LJ insists that medals aren't why he competes. He does it for the love of the sport. You just follow your passion, he advises. Follow your heart. If you want to do it, you're going to find ways to do it. Just as street-style athletes find their own way across a course, Eleanor, Gaeon, Lily, and LJ are carving their own paths in the competitive world of winter sports. Here are some winter sports terms to know, okay? Carve. You carve it up. It's a verb. To execute an advanced maneuver, moving quickly down a slope on skis or on a snowboard without making wide turns. Okay. A half pipe, that's a noun, by the way. A large snow-covered tube for performing jumps on skis or a snowboard. A knuckle huck, I wanted to know about that one. It is a ski or snowboard event that involves using the curved upper section of a slope to perform tricks. Then there's slope style. That's a type of freestyle skiing or snowboarding in which the competitors use rails for sliding and massive ramps for jumping. Then there's street style, a ski and snowboard event that is similar to slope style on a shorter, flatter course. And finally, superpipe, a large half-pipe structure used in extreme sports, usually with vertical walls that are higher than 16 feet. Next article. Let's see. Let's do, yeah, stick with Time for Kids. Safer Streets is the name of this article by Jamie Joyce. One morning, Patricia Miller was taking a walk on a busy street near her home in Goodyear, Arizona, when a car nearly jumped the curb. Thankfully, she was unharmed, but the car came very, very close, Miller told Time for Kids. Miller and her grandson William often walked together on that road to get ice cream. When William went to visit that evening, she told him what had happened. See, is this him talking? William Miller told Time for Kids, I've always known that there's lots of street racing on Estrella Parkway, he told Time for Kids. But after I heard that my grandma was nearly hit by a car, I was not happy. So I asked my dad, what can we do to fix this? And he said, let's go to the city council. That's exactly what they did. The experience has shown William the power of speaking out to improve people's lives. Voicing concerns. Goodyear City Council meetings are open to the public, with time set aside for people to comment on issues affecting their community. When it was time, when it was his turn to speak, William, then 8 years old, dressed in a blue suit and tie, stepped up to the microphone. He spoke about people racing cars on Estrella Parkway. It's very dangerous, he said. I wonder if you guys have any solution to fix this. Mayor Joe Pizzillo, he was impressed. In Goodyear, he says, we encourage young people to step up, get more involved in civics, to understand how local government works. So when I saw William come up to the podium, it was very refreshing. Turns out plans to install a traffic signal on Estrella Parkway were already in place, but when William spoke at the meeting and shared his observations with Goodyear's police chief, it brought more attention to the need for safer streets, Pizzillo says. Last summer, about 6 months after the January 2024 council meeting, a new traffic light was up and running. After that happened, William says, I felt like I could do anything. Helping others. Stories about William's efforts to improve his community have appeared on the local news and on national TV. He has received an Outstanding Citizen of Goodyear Award from his school district. William's dad also named William as proud. He says, I knew something good was going to happen when he walked up there to speak at the council meeting. What community issues does William plan to tackle next? I'm not sure yet, he says. I need to keep exploring. But he's confident that Pizzillo will listen. I've told William that he's probably going to be sitting in this office at some time in the future. Whether or not William will one day be mayor remains to be seen, but he does aspire to a life of public service. I really want to be the president, the fourth grader says. For now, William is happy with the changes on Estrella Parkway. You don't see cars racing each other to the end of the road, he says, and it feels much safer. His grandmother agrees. Inspired? Let William's story inspire you to speak out for change in your community. Okay, let's do one more article from Time for Kids magazine. TFK explains tariffs. Didn't say who wrote this, but somebody must have. President Donald Trump has ordered that tariffs be imported on goods from Canada, China, and Mexico. And here TFK explains. This article is probably several days old. First question they ask and answer, what is a tariff? A tariff is a tax on an item imported or brought in from another country. For example, an American company may want to sell cars that are made in Germany. Since the cars would be brought into the U.S. from another country, the company would have to pay a tax. This tax is extra money that goes to the U.S. government. Not all foreign goods have tariffs. The U.S. has made agreements with countries such as Canada and Mexico. American companies have been able to trade with these countries without tariffs, but those agreements may be changing. Why is the U.S. government imposing tariffs, you ask yourself? A White House released a statement on February 1st saying that the new tariffs are meant to hold Canada, China, and Mexico accountable. Trump's administration is demanding the countries fix issues relating to U.S. borders. If these countries agree to work with the U.S. on these issues, Trump has said that he may reconsider the tariffs, which he's done for a month. On February 3rd, the U.S. agreed to delay the tariffs, there it is, on Mexican and Canadian imports for 30 days. This happened because the countries reached deals with the U.S. At press time, the tariffs on the imports from China had been put in place. Whom would these tariffs affect? Tariffs can affect foreign countries by making their products harder to export and sell. They can also affect American consumers who can expect to see higher prices in stores. What items would be more expensive with these tariffs? The new tariff target countries that currently supply U.S. with a wide range of goods. Studies suggest that U.S. shoppers could see higher prices on items such as electronics, meat, and produce. And the last question they got here, what have been some reactions to the news? Well, Canada said it would impose its own tariffs against the U.S. This is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on February 1st, "We will stand strong for Canada." China says it will also impose tariffs on U.S. goods. Some U.S. business owners are worried, says Zach Davis, co-owner of California Ice Cream Shop. He told the Associated Press, "I feel bad about always having to raise prices." On social media, Trump wrote that the impact of the tariffs would be worth the price. Okay, let's go to another publication. Right here on Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. Let's see, what is this? Ranger Rick. Got a couple articles, maybe three, that I shall be reading from this. This article entitled, "From Beans to Treats," by Kate Hoffman. Where does chocolate come from? Believe it or not, it all begins with a tree. On Valentine's Day, a gift of chocolate is one way to say, "I love you." But chocolate is a treat most people love to eat at any time of year. In fact, people around the world eat about 16 billion pounds of it every year. It all starts with seeds from a tropical tree called cacao. Cacao. The seeds are often called cacao beans. There's that cacao. But how do these turn these magical beans into sweets like the ones we've stacked up here? They got a picture of them stacked up. It commands me to turn the page for a step-by-step look at the whole process. All right, I'm going to do it. No, I swear. Growing cacao. Cacao trees first grew in South and Central America. The ancient Maya and Aztec people used cacao beans to make a bitter, energy-filled drink. In the 1500s, Spanish explorers took some cacao back to Europe. The people added sugar to make a drink more like the hot chocolate we enjoy now. And over time, chocolate became popular around the world. But it wasn't until the 1800s when people first used it to make candies. Today, more than half of the world's cacao is grown in the West African countries of, you can pronounce this, Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana. The rest comes from many other tropical countries, and most is grown on small family farms. Harvesting cacao. Cacao farmers usually harvest the beans twice each year, and here's how. Picking. Pods are ripe when they turn from green to colorful shades of yellow, red, maroon, or purple. That's when the farmer carefully cuts the ripe pods from the tree. Transporting. Pods are piled up and moved to where they'll be opened. Here they are loaded into baskets on the back of a mule. They got pictures displaying that. Opening. The pods are cracked open with a wooden mallet. Inside each pod are 30 to 40 beans covered in sticky white pulp. Yikes. The pulp tastes sweet, but you wouldn't want to eat a fresh bean. It would be so bitter that you'd spit it right out. More work ahead. Next, the farmers prepare the beans to get them ready for sale. Fermenting. The pulpy beans are covered and left to sit for a few days. That allows the pulp to drain away and chemicals inside the beans to change. This is getting complicated. Drying. The beans are spread out in the sun to dry. They get raked often, so they dry evenly. Next, they are packed and shipped to chocolate makers around the world. Roasting and grinding. The beans are roasted, which brings out their flavor. Then they are broken into tiny bits called nibs, N-I-B-S. The nibs are crushed and heated to make a thick paste, which is still very bitter. Mixing. Sugar is next. Adding a little makes dark chocolate. A little more makes semi-sweet chocolate. Adding even more sugar and some powdered milk turns it into milk chocolate. shaping. Chocolate makers then turn the finished recipes into many different things. Below, they got a picture of a machine that coats puck-shaped peanut butter sweets with melted chocolate as they pass underneath. I've seen that in the commercials with the swirling chocolate. Below that is a tray of finished truffles just waiting to be taste-tested. Commands me to turn the page to taste-test a chocolate recipe myself. I'm not going to do it. No, I won't do it. I'll read the rest of the article, though. It's not all sweet. No, no. The story of chocolate has a bitter side. In many countries, areas of rainforests are cleared for growing crops, including cacao. And that results in a huge loss of homes for wildlife. Cacao farming is hard work, too, and many of those farmers don't even make enough money to support their families. What can you do? Well, there's some good news. In the wild, cacao trees grow in the shade of bigger trees. So some farmers plant cacao without cutting the rainforest. By choosing chocolate labeled organic or regenerative, you help support this earth-friendly farming. You can also look for chocolate with a fair trade label. This means better pay and working conditions for the farmers. Now, that's pretty sweet. Indeed. Indeed. Next article. Sticking with Ranger Rick. Kathy Cranking wrote this one called Ocean Romance. Ocean Romeos have different ways of winning over their special Valentines. Check out some of their best dating trips right here. Love connection, sure, there are plenty of fish in the sea, but for me, a tiny male angler fish. In the pitch dark depths, it can be hard to find love. Luckily, with my great sense of smell, I have no trouble sniffing out a mate in the dark. And when I find Ms. Right, I grab on and don't let go, literally. Using my teeth, I attach myself to her body. Yikes. Soon, our bodies grow together. What? And we stay as one for the rest of our lives. Then it says, romantic, huh? Let's see. Wave her over when I see a passing fiddler crab cutie. This is this one. I know just how to get her attention. I stand near the entrance of my beach burrow and wave my big, beautiful claw back and forth. If she seems interested, I run toward her, then run back to my burrow. That's what I do. I keep doing this until she follows me. And we get to the entrance of my burrow, I drum my claw on the ground. If she joins me in the burrow, then I know she's my Valentine. Say it with sand. It can take a lot of work to impress a female Japanese pufferfish, but I've got it down to a fine art. I create a masterpiece to show her that I care. Flapping my fins, I swim along the seafloor, sculpting the sand into a circular pattern. Very zen. It could take me more than a week to finish it. If a female likes my love nest, she'll lay her eggs in the center of it. Dazzle her. I'm a pretty good-looking guy, of course, but it takes more than that to catch the eye of a lady cuttlefish. She wants to see a show, so that's what I give her. In less than a second, I can change the look of my skin. I flash neon rainbow colors, create patterns of dots and lines, and even make stripes move in waves across my body. If she's impressed by my dazzling looks, and how could she not be, she'll be mine. Seal the deal. A male hooded seal like me usually hangs out alone, but during mating season, lots of us seals come together to find mates. When I spy a female I like, I really turn on the charm. But instead of blowing her a kiss, I blow her a balloon. Inside my nose is a sack that I can inflate. It makes a big red balloon that really wows the ladies. In addition to having a nose balloon, I have a head balloon. It's a hood that I can inflate to scare off any male challengers. Yikes. Pebbles are forever. Diamonds may be a girl's best friend, but a female Gentoo penguin prefers a different kind of rock. She likes pebbles. Why? Because in our Antarctic home, it's impossible to find twigs or leaves to build nests with. So we build pebble nests. When I want to win a lady's heart, I pick out a nice pebble and bring it to her. If she approves, we'll collect pebbles together and build a nest. Sometimes I even steal pebbles from other penguins' nests. I'm not afraid to ruffle a few feathers. It's all in the name of love, right? And next one here, all the right moves. When I want a female lined seahorse to know I like her, I take her dancing. I show her my moves, and she matches them. Each morning, we meet to do our fancy dance. It's as if we are performing a slow ballet together. We swim in circles, twist our tails together, and even change colors. This is our way of showing each other that we'll be dancing to the same tune for the rest of our lives. Flirting with flashes. A sea firefly, like me, is a shelled creature, only about the size of a sesame seed. So how does a little guy find a mate in this huge ocean? Well, I join other males in a firefly flash mob that makes the ladies come swimming. Here's how it works. Male sea fireflies sneeze out tiny balls of blue glowing goop. I don't like where this is going. Attractive, right? I'll swim along, sneezing out goopy balls as I go. At the same time, hundreds of other sea firefly dudes are sneezing out glowing balls, too. We all dance together in unison, making waves of light in the dark ocean. It's a flirty fireworks show that lures the ladies right to us. Let's see. Nest appeal. I know that female Garibaldi likes to see a well-kept nest. So I work really hard on mine. I make it in the garden of a plant-like algae using my teeth. I trim the algae so it's nice and neat, and I pull out plants that try and grow there. Sometimes other animals, such as sea stars, may trespass through my nest. When that happens, I pick them up with my mouth, and I move them right out. When an interested female comes along, I further impress her by swimming in loops while loudly grinding my teeth. If all that irresistible stuff does the trick, she'll lay her eggs in my beautiful nest. And they got one more here. That special scent of ocean Romeos. They aren't the only ones with dating tips. No, no. Some Juliets like me, a female reef shark, have great ways of attracting male admirers. Since reef sharks have a super sense of smell, I just let them follow their noses right to me. I do it by releasing a special scent called a pheromone. One whiff of this love potion, and they'll come swimming my way. Come swimming my way. Okay, let's do one more article. From Ranger Rick. Right here on Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. This is called The Other White Bear by Ann Cecil. Found in only a single forest on Earth, the spirit bear is one of the rarest bears in the world. Starts out here, wait a minute, did a polar bear lose its way and find itself in a forest? Nope, that's a Kermode bear. Did I pronounce it? Yeah, Kermode bear. A type of American black bear that sometimes has white fur. That's right, a white black bear. It has another name too, spirit bear. It got that ghostly name because seeing one is like glimpsing a creature from another world. But spotting a spirit bear isn't as easy as you might think. No, no, no. Scientists believe there may be only a few hundred or fewer spirit bears in the wild. Mess that up. They all live in part of the Great Bear Rainforest along the western coast of Canada. But you don't need to travel to discover more about them. Just turn the page and experience their mysterious world. I'm turning the page. They've intrigued me. Why white? You're asking yourself here. Only about 1 in 10 of the Kermode bears in their small section of the Great Bear Rainforest is white. Scientists believe that thousands of years ago, a black bear was born with a mutation. Or a change in one of its genes that made its fur white. A gene is a section of DNA, the microscopic set of instructions in the cells of every living thing. All the spirit bears today are related to that first bear, which passed the mutation down to some of its cubs, grand cubs, and so on. Family life. A spirit bear spends its time the same way a black-furred Kermode bear does. It lives alone except for a female with her cubs. A female, after mating, will find a cozy den and spend the cold winter months in it. In December or January, she gives birth to 1 to 4 cubs there, where they stay snuggled with mom for the rest of the winter, drinking her milk. After they leave the den, the cubs stay with their mother for another year, learning all about bear life. Because of how genes are passed between generations, a white-furred bear can give birth to black cubs, and a black-furred bear can have white cubs. But no matter what their fur color is, they all have bear-sized appetites. Snacking on salmon. Most of the year, spirit bears eat berries, grass-like sedges, and other plant life. But in the autumn, salmon return from the ocean to the rivers and streams where they hatched, right where hungry bears hang out. Spirit bears are sometimes a little better at catching salmon than black-furred bears are. This is most likely because it's harder for the salmon to see the white bears through the water, so the fish don't swim out of reach in time. It's not just that the bears get fed by the salmon, the forest does too. After a bear finishes its salmon supper, it leaves the unwanted bits behind on the ground. Soon those leftovers break down into the soil to feed their nutrients to the trees and other forest plants. Saving spirit bears. Unfortunately, the number of spirit bears might be shrinking. This could be because there are fewer salmon in the rivers than in past. The changing climate is making water too warm in some areas for salmon to survive, which means less food for spirit bears. Also, people sometimes cut down too many trees and catch too many salmon in the places where the bears live. The people of these, if you can pronounce this, Kitasuhaihai Nation, they live in parts of the Great Bear Rainforest, as did their ancestors for thousands of years. One of their legends is about Raven, the creator. He made the spirit bear to remind people of the Ice Age, so they will be thankful for the green, fertile forest they live in today. Now all people must work to protect the forest and the bears that call it home. Okay, let's go over to newsforkids.net. This is an article entitled, Bonobos Can Think About What You Don't Know. That's kind of confusing. I hope they know what I know now, because I don't know what I know. As humans, we can think about what other people are thinking and understand that their ideas might be different from ours. Scientists call this theory of mind. An important question is whether animals can do the same. A recent experiment suggests that bonobo apes may share this ability. Humans spend a lot of their time working together, sharing information, and helping each other out. Theory of mind, being able to imagine what someone else might be thinking, is an important part of human success. Scientists have long wondered whether any other animals share this ability. There are signs that some animals may. For example, chimpanzees have been seen warning others about a nearby snake when they believe other chimps haven't seen the snake yet. A recent experiment suggests that bonobos can also think about what others are thinking. Bonobos are very intelligent apes. They have been taught to communicate using signs or symbols. They're also known for being friendly and often solve problems by working together. To study how bonobos think, researchers at Johns Hopkins University came up with a clever experiment. The scientists worked with three male bonobos at a special research center called the Ape Initiative. The goal of the experiment was to see whether the apes could understand when a human didn't know something. In the experiment, scientist Luke Townrow, he sat across from a table from a bonobo. Another scientist hid a small snack, like a grape, under one of three cups that were turned upside down on the table. The bonobo was always able to watch the snack being hidden. The ape was also able to see Mr. Townrow, about half of the time Mr. Townrow wasn't able to see which cup the snack was hidden under. The researchers wanted to see if the bonobos acted differently when they knew that Mr. Townrow didn't know where the snack was hidden. Once the treat was hidden, Mr. Townrow always acted the same. He would look at the cups and say, where is the grape? And he would wait for 10 seconds, giving the bonobos time to respond. The results showed that when Mr. Townrow hadn't seen where the snack was hidden, the bonobos pointed to the cup with the hidden treat more quickly and much more often. The experiment suggests that the bonobos were able to think about what Mr. Townrow knew. They seemed to understand that Mr. Townrow didn't know something that they did. The experiment wasn't perfect, but there were only three bonobos in the study, and one of the bonobos seemed to point all the time no matter what. Also, some scientists have pointed out that these bonobos grew up around humans and might not represent wild bonobos. Still, the results show that bonobos have a theory of mind. They have an ability to think about what others are thinking and can change their behavior to communicate when someone is missing important information. Did you know? Humans and other apes all developed from an earlier kind of ape that lived long ago. Scientists say it's possible that this shared ancestor also had the ability to think about what others might be thinking. This skill may have helped these ancient apes work together. And let's read one more article from News for Kids before moving on. This is entitled Marshall Islands Creates Huge Marine Reserve. Bum, 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 bum. The government of the Marshall Islands has protected a huge area of ocean around two remote atolls. The step is designed to protect important marine and bird life and to help scientists learn more about the area. The government says it is their first Marine Protected Area, or MPA, but it won't be their last. The Republic of the Marshall Islands, or RMI, is a small island nation in the Pacific Ocean. It lies roughly halfway between Hawaii and the Philippines. The country has 5 main islands, 29 large atolls, and over 1,000 other small islands. Bikini Atoll is perhaps the most famous of the Marshall Island atolls. It was used by the U.S. for testing nuclear weapons after World War II. The new MPA sets aside 18,500 square miles of ocean where no fishing is allowed. That's larger in size than the area of Denmark, the Netherlands, or Sweden. The protected areas surrounds two remote atolls, Baikar, B-I-K-A-R Atoll, and Bokak Atoll. That's B-O-K-A-K. No one lives on the two atolls, which are far away from the rest of the Marshall Islands, including Bikini Atoll. Because they are so far removed from people, the oceans around the atolls are in excellent shape. In 2023, scientists from National Geographic's Pristine Sea Project worked with the experts in the Marshall Islands to study the area that is now protected. The group made 452 dives and spent over 640 hours underwater. Enric Sala, who started the Pristine Seas Project, calls the area a time machine. He says the coral reefs around the atolls are so healthy that diving there is like diving in the ocean of 1,000 years ago. The underwater life near the atolls include many different kinds of fish. In fact, scientists say that there are more fish there than any other reef in the Pacific Ocean. The waters in the MPA are home to a large number of deep-sea sharks. There are also many giant clams in the area. Researchers say that there may even be marine life there that scientists have never seen before. The MPA is designed to protect, also designed to protect, life out of the water. The area contains the largest nesting site for green turtles in the Marshall Islands. It also is home to more seabirds than any other place in the country. The people of the Marshall Islands have strong connections to the ocean. They use the word, see if we can pronounce this, Riamanalak, which means to look forward to the future, guided by their own history and knowledge. The RMI government believes protecting sea life in this large area will also help marine life outside the protected area, and that will help local fishermen and others who depend on the sea. The ocean is life, says Glenn Joseph, who leads the group responsible for protecting the waters of the Marshall Islands. Our future depends on protecting our ocean. Okay, let's go to another publication right here on Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. Let's do some science news. Science News Explorers. This is entitled, This Teen Engineer's Device Sniffs Out Common Food Allergens. The AI-trained sensor can pick out eggs, peanuts, cashews, and other ingredients in foods, says Maria Temming. I wrote this article. Let's see if I can pronounce this name. Samvith Mahadevan. I like that. 14 years old. He's had severe food allergies his whole life. He's been exposed to allergens when eating foods that were not labeled properly. To protect people like him from allergic reactions, Sam Vith decided to build his own allergen detector. Most detectors like these are costly. Usually they must touch the food they're testing. But Sam Vith's inexpensive sensor smells particles wafting off food into the air. Then it uses artificial intelligence to see if the food contains common allergens. Sam Vith trained his device with machine learning to detect eggs, peanuts, pistachios, almonds, cashews, and walnuts. In tests, his system could sniff out those allergens in foods, such as cookies and curries, with 94 to 97% accuracy. An aspiring engineer, Sam Vith did this project as a seventh grader at Canyon Vista Middle School in Austin, Texas. His research earned him the Lemuelson Foundation Award at the 2024 Thermo Fisher Scientific Junior Innovators Challenge. That competition is run by the Society for Science, which also publishes this thing right here. Science News Explores. In this interview, Sam Vith shares his science fair experiences and advice. First off, they asked him, how did you feel when you first saw your results? And he says, it was really exciting because I had to go through a lot of different trial and error, and there were definitely lots of failures along the way. So seeing his sensor accurately pick out allergens really felt motivating because it showed me that this idea has a lot of potential. With further development, Sam Vith says, we could save a lot of lives. What were some of the failures that you encountered? When he first started training his system, the accuracy was very, very low, Sam Vith says. I had to try a lot of things. First, he tried altering the allergen samples he was using to train his system, but that didn't work. It wasn't until he tweaked some parts of his machine learning program that the sensor's accuracy shot up. When I finally figured out the right combination of those settings, it felt like, oh, that's good. Ooh, good. What's the most important thing you learned? Once you think about a problem you want to solve, you can keep it in the back of your mind. You have to be observant all the time and have a curious mind, Sam Vith says. He got the idea to use scent for detecting allergens by just watching an ant in his kitchen home on sugar from afar. Even the smallest things can spur good ideas. Any advice for science fair newbies? Being completely new to your project area can actually be a good thing, Sam Vith says. When he started his project, he didn't know that most current allergen sensors work by analyzing the proteins in food. So when he came up with the idea to detect scent, it was in part because I didn't place any imaginary restrictions on myself. Sometimes inexperience triggers out-of-the-box thinking, and even a complete beginner could come up with the idea of the future. Next article here. Sticking with Science News Explores. For teens, virtual reality worlds aren't all fun and games. Oh, no. More than a third surveyed for one study reported abuse in these virtual environments. Let's see. Kathy Ann Kowalski wrote this particular article. It goes like this. Who is this? Alex P., the 12-year-old lives in Strongville, Ohio, and he says, breaking out of reality and exploring different worlds is what Alex P. enjoys most about using his virtual reality or VR headset. Daryl M. of Bedford, Texas, enjoys the feeling of being inside game worlds when he plays with a VR headset. He also likes how programs respond to his movements. The game follows what you do, and that's really cool, the 14-year-old says. Let's see, who is this? Vincent C. of Bozeman, Montana says, it's just a lot more immersive than if it were a normal screen. VR headsets help make-believe worlds seem a little more real, he explains. Virtual reality refers to the artificial 3D worlds that headsets and linked computer games let you enter. But VR devices aren't all fun and games. A new study finds that more than a third of teen VR users have been on the receiving end of one or more types of abuse. See, who is this? Smir Hendula? Where's he from? Doesn't say. He says this: these emerging technologies are awesome and are only going to get better, more immersive, and more life-changing. But teen and tween users should know about the risks, he adds. Hinduja is a criminologist at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. He worked on a new study with Justin Patchen. He's also a criminologist. Patchen works at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. The two founded the Cyberbullying Research Center based in Jupiter, Florida. VR's hidden risks. For their study, the pair surveyed a nationwide sample of 5,005 U.S. teens. Roughly one in three who answered said that they own a VR headset. That's similar to what another survey found last spring. It was conducted by Piper Sandler, a company that conducts market research on various technologies. About 44% of teens in the new study by Hinduja and Patchen said they had been targeted with hate speech and slurs at least once. Roughly 1 in 11 said that happened many times. Among other findings, more than 1 in 3 of teen VR users said they had experienced bullying or harassment. More than 4 in every 10 teen VR users reported trolling. Trolls are people who make nasty or inflammatory comments online. And that's not all, Chevy. More than 1/6 of teen VR users had faced sexual harassment. Girls were targeted more than boys, and almost 1 in every 4 had been catfished. In other words, someone impersonated a teen or someone else to deceive their target. Similar types of abuse happen on social media, but it's difficult to compare the two types of online experiences, Hinduja says. The immersive nature of virtual reality environments, he suggests, might boost teens' emotional responses to abuse. Let's see, he says this. Also, users often feel a strong connection and sense of identity with the avatars they carefully construct. So abuse of your virtual character, he worries, might hit harder than text comments on a social media post. Protecting yourself. Bum, 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 bum. Both boys and girls in the study sometimes removed themselves from a virtual world if others were abusive. Girls were more likely than boys to pick a specific avatar to avoid harassment. Girls were also more likely to set boundaries for the personal space around their avatar. Overall, though, teens didn't use such steps often. Most teens did not report experiencing the type of abuse the researchers asked about. Still, it is important to take basic safety steps, the team says. Let's see what this Hinduja says. You should take time to learn how you can quickly and easily block, remote, and mute others. Learn how to set virtual boundaries and know how to report any abuse by other players. The person acting badly won't find out who you are, he notes. Also, identify at least one trusted adult you can talk with if abuse does occur. They can help you if you're not sure how to deal with an online problem. The new study, who is this, Linda Charman, Wellesley, Massachusetts, in this new study, is one of the first to assess harassment experiences in the VR world. And how teens can protect themselves. That's Linda Charmreman. She has the Youth and Media and Wellbeing Lab at Wellesley Centers for Women in Massachusetts. Future research, she says, might focus on how much of these behaviors actually distress young people. The young findings could help parents, safety programs, and VR content creators develop better ways to keep users safe. Vincent, Alec, and Daryl all pay attention to the age guidelines for games. Alec works with his parents to decide which ones are appropriate for him. Vincent usually plays games only with people he knows. Always be vigilant when using any device and exploring any online space. Don't assume that harm can't happen to you, there it is, and make good use of the program's safety settings. Those features, he emphasizes, are there for you to use to control your online experience. Indeed, he adds, they've been designed to ensure that it remains safe, comfortable, and fun for you. And let's do one more article here from Science News Explorers. Jane Rigby helped make the James Webb Telescope a superstar. Curiosity about the universe and a love for scientific instruments drive this astronomer. Lisa Grossman wrote this article, and it goes a little like this. One of a telescope's operator's main job is to keep stray light out of the instrument. Unwelcome light can wash out the cosmic glimmers of distant stars and galaxies. During more than a decade of work on NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, Jane Rigby obsessed over minimizing light leaks. She had extraordinary success. Rigby herself, now a senior project scientist for JWST, is a source of light. And she says, I don't know how she... Oh, this is somebody else. Karen Sharon says, I don't know how she does everything that she does and does everything well. She's an astronomer, Karen Sharon, by the way, at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She gets giddy, Sharon says of Rigby. It could be about figuring out a technical bug or discovering this super exciting thing about a galaxy. Her face lights up. Rigby got interested in a career in space around the age of 12 after she saw Sally Ride speak at a local college. Ride was the first American woman in space. As a college student, Rigby got her first experience using a telescope for research at the McDonald Observatory in Texas. She and her colleagues aimed a telescope at a distant quasar. The project was plagued by light leaks and ultimately yielded no data. But it was really fun, Rigby says. I was learning everything, trying to learn how the telescope worked. Since then, Rigby has used many telescopes, including ones in Hawaii, in Chile, and even in space. Those instruments have helped her investigate how galaxies evolve, along with these supermassive black holes hiding within them, says Rigby. I will use any telescope I can get my hands on. All that telescope time meant that she was ready to join JWST team when the opportunity came in 2010. To work on JWST, Rigby took a job at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Before launch, most of her time was devoted to making sure that changes to the telescope's design wouldn't mess up the science. After the telescope launched in 2021, her job shifted to characterizing how well the telescope works, and JWST is basically a dream come true. There's better image quality, higher sensitivity, faster response times, and a longer potential mission lifetime than predicted before the launch. Plus, there's practically no light leaks. It's not an accident that the telescope works so well, Rigby says, pointing to a huge amount of work by tens of thousands of people. While the telescope working so well, Rigby could turn her attention to scientific questions. She helps lead an observing program that looks at galaxies whose light has been magnified by foreground objects. That helps astronomers glimpse how the galaxies form stars. Rigby has also lit a path for queer astronomers and others who are historically underrepresented in astronomy. She has been out as part of the LGBTQ+ community since 2000. She has devoted much of her career to holding the door open for others. She has helped set up groups and meetings for making astronomy more inclusive. A current priority is making sure trans people feel safe and welcome in the field. I didn't grow up with any queer role models, Rigby says. I hope I'm the last generation for which that is true. Okay, let's move over to Frontiers for Young Minds, right here on Bigler's World. This article entitled, Softer, Safer, Smarter, Robotic Hands Inspired by Nature. Nature, Mr. Beale. Sylvia Terrell and Luong Li Yaili wrote this article. It goes a little like this. Soft grippers. Imagine You are in a factory. What do you see around you? You might picture robots and machines doing their best to help human workers make things. Now zoom in and imagine what these robots are actually doing. Many robots in factories do what is called pick-and-place operations, taking objects from one place and delivering them somewhere else. Robots need good hands to do this work. So what kind of hands should a robot have? One answer might be that they should have hands just like ours. Unfortunately, human hands are surprisingly complex, and good human-like robot hands are still only seen in movies. Robots in factories may only need to perform some of the tasks our human hands can do, so robot creators might want simpler and cheaper hands, which are called grippers. A typical robot gripper consists of just two fingers. You can create one by pinching your thumb and index finger together. It is pretty simple and effective. While rigid pinching robot grippers are strong and great for car parts and steel beams, they can make it difficult for robots to pick up delicate objects like fruits and vegetables. While you can hold lemons gently in your hand, a typical robot gripper must pinch the fruit like lemons hard enough to pick them up, which could damage them. Humans can also bend their fingers around the lemons, and human skin applies just enough contact so the lemons are held firmly. These abilities are key aspects of a new type of gripper called soft grippers. Today, there are lots of soft grippers, each unique in its own design and abilities, and some are used in real-world applications. In this article, we have compiled some of these examples. Finding function from fingers, floaties, and fish fins. The first soft robots looked quite similar to your fingers, if your fingers had 10 times more joints. These were called continuum robots. Is that right? Continuum? I think it's continuum robots. And just like our fingers, scientists use muscle-like tendons and cables to bend them. So continuum robots had a series of rigid links connected by bendable soft joints. The joints can flop around as long as the cable has no tension on it, but when engineered correctly, these human-like robot hands are strong and flexible. But what if we want to replicate something softer and natural-looking, like an octopus tentacle? Tentacles do not have links and joints, which means that when they bend, there's no main bending point. They just curve. To replicate a tentacle structure, robot creators can make an enclosed pocket of air that deforms a certain way when you change the amount of air in it. A balloon or pool floaty could be considered a soft robot if it expands in a certain way when it is inflated. These soft grippers are based on the principle of pneumatic networks, through which pumping air into a finger structure causes it to bend in a desired way. If these fingers are arranged into pairs, trios, or more, a typical soft gripper is created. Way back in 1997, a biologist named Leif Kanis was studying how fish moved, and he noticed that fish tails have a unique bone structure. When water or a finger pushes against the fish tail, it bends inward toward your finger instead of bending away like a piece of paper would. This phenomenon, which helps fish control the flow of water around them, was later used in robot grippers. Called fin ray effect grippers, these robot fingers simply surround objects they touch. When combined with a soft material, fin ray grippers are a great example of soft grippers, improving the usefulness of two-fingered grippers by making the fingers softer and smarter. In contrast to, pneu nets? These grippers do not need an air supply, which makes them easier to use in environments like space or underwater. Since the first fin ray gripper was developed, you can now find them online, ready to be 3D printed, or even in toy shops. Materials that can memorize a shape. What if we want to make a gripper that does not need motors or air pumps? Luckily, there is a never-ending sea of wild and wacky materials in soft robot research, and one popular type has a memory of its previous shapes. If you've ever wondered if a piece of metal or plastic could remember what it looked like when it was made, well, some of them can. Metals that can do this are called shape memory alloys. and such plastics are called shape memory polymers. These shape recovery processes can be used to bend grippers in the desired way by heating them up. There are many SMA and SMP soft robots being researched. Some of these grippers are even used in applications where the object is already hot, which means the SMA gripper only needs to get close to the object, and it will bend and grasp the object by itself. Not all environments are hot or cold enough for SMA soft grippers to change shape, but luckily we can heat things with an electric current. By hooking up some wires to an SMA soft gripper, we can control the bending and recovery of the materials easily. To be as sticky as gecko feet. Geckos can climb on smooth surfaces, including glass, and stick to ceilings as if gravity does not exist. What makes their feet so special? It turns out they defy gravity by having really tiny structures on their feet. When in contact with walls, these microscopic structures generate weak molecular-level sticky bonds called van der Waals forces, which, when multiplied across many points on contact, become large enough for geckos to cling to ceilings. Since humans can now make very small things, we have replicated these structures and even produced tape rolls with these sticky surfaces. We can create soft grippers with many contact points on which we attach artificial gecko skin, leading to a stronger grip and new ways for soft robots to interact with the world. Can you build a soft gripper at home? In cartoons like Doraemon, characters sometimes have balls as hands, but seem to pick things up with no problem. Their hands look just like a soft gripper called a jamming gripper. This physical principle behind these grippers is simple. You take a bunch of small items like beads, rice, powders, or coffee beans, put them in a bag and suck all the air out from between them. The floppy bag then freezes in place, becoming a unique solid object, trapping any object you might have pressed into it. You may have seen this principle when you open a packet of coffee grounds or vacuum-packed rice. When you buy it at the supermarket, it is pretty solid, but when you open it and the air goes inside, it becomes floppy. Perhaps some scientists who loved their coffee made the first jamming gripper by filling a balloon with their favorite coffee beans. With just a few household items, coffee, a balloon, a piece of tubing, and a vacuum cleaner, you can easily follow their footsteps and make your own jamming gripper. In summary, lots of exciting new soft robots and grippers are out there, born from a combination of natural inspiration and human engineering. The future is already among us. We just need to look with an open mind. And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.